Good morning. The National Weather Service is defending its forecasting after a flat.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. New York's Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Services is maintaining a heightened level of security amid global threats, and they're also helping New Yorkers prepare for extreme weather. We'll hear from Commissioner Jackie Bray about how the state's working to keep New Yorkers safe. Plus, local economic perspective with James B. Huntington. A beloved Catskills diner gets the Hollywood treatment. The Phoenician Diner returns to the small screen in Severance on Apple TV+. Plus, Peace, Love, and a Cello, bringing the Woodstock experience back to life in a way you've never heard before. Plus, it's our summer fun drive. Donate now at 845-482-4141 or wjffradio.org.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. Camp Mystic in Kerr County, Texas, says it's grieving the loss of 27 campers and counselors in catastrophic flash flooding. The Christian Summer Camp released a statement this morning asking for prayers and expressing gratitude for the support it's received. At least 82 people were killed across the state. Texas Congressman Joaquin Castro's district is still recovering from deadly flash flooding last month in San Antonio. He told NPR's Morning Edition, the immediate focus after Friday's disaster is the search effort and then asking tough questions.
Right now, we still have a rescue effort going on, and finding the rest of those people alive, hopefully, is the priority. But you know, after that, in the months to come, I think we owe it to everybody to make sure that there's a thorough investigation of what went wrong.
President Trump has signed a disaster declaration to send more resources to Kerr County. NPR's Deepa Shivaram says he may visit the flood zone later this week.
Trump told reporters that he wanted to, quote, leave a little time so that he wouldn't be in the way of recovery efforts from the flooding, which he called, quote, absolutely horrible. Trump's Secretary of Homeland Security, Kristi Noem, has already been on the ground. Rains on July 4th caused severe flash flooding in central Texas. Despite flood warnings from the National Weather Service, the severity of the storm was a surprise for many. When asked if the administration was investigating whether recent cuts in the federal government workforce left key vacancies open at the National Weather Service, Trump said, quote, they didn't. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News.
President Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will meet today at the White House. Trump is pushing for a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. The ceasefire proposal calls for a 60-day pause in the fighting and the release of some hostages held by Hamas. Israel would release Palestinian prisoners. Israel sent a negotiating team to Qatar on Sunday for peace talks. Stocks opened lower this morning as investors brace for several more weeks of tariff uncertainty. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow fell about 90 points in early trading.
This is the week the Trump administration had threatened to impose higher tariffs on goods from countries that failed to strike new trade agreements with the U.S., but it now appears those higher import taxes won't take effect until at least August 1st. That means U.S. importers have at least 3 more weeks in limbo, not knowing what kind of bill they might face when bringing foreign products into the country. OPEC and its allies announced plans over the weekend to boost production by more than 500,000 barrels a day next month. That could put more downward pressure on oil prices. AAA says retail gasoline prices in the U.S. have already been falling to an average of $3.14 a gallon. That's about 4 cents lower than a week ago, but a penny more than this time last month. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. One beneficiary of the tax and spending bill signed into law by President Trump on the 4th of July is a type of coal used to make steel. From member station WESA, Reed Frazier reports companies that mine metallurgical coal are in line to receive a 2.5% tax credit.
The massive bill classifies metallurgical coal as a critical mineral and thus eligible for a tax credit that had gone mainly to materials used in clean energy. Metallurgical or met coal is used to make steel in a blast furnace and is a big greenhouse gas polluter. Hillary Lewis, an analyst with the environmental nonprofit Industrious Labs, says the bill will have more of an economic impact overseas since most met coal produced in the U.S. is exported.
So it's going to make iron and steel produced outside of the U.S. cheaper.
The top destinations for U.S. met coal are India, Brazil, and Japan. For NPR News, I'm Reed Frazier in Pittsburgh.
The running of the bulls is underway in Pamplona, Spain. A stampede of bulls opened the festival today, pounding along cobblestone streets with thousands of runners. Spectators who prefer to be on the sidelines are watching from behind street barricades and up high on balconies. Animal rights activists are there, too, marching through the city, wearing horns and waving protest signs. Spanish media reports a few injuries so far. Suriname's parliament elected its first female president. Jennifer Geerling-Simons is a 71-year-old doctor who says she'll focus on stabilizing the economy. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. It's our summer fun drive, day one officially, and we're looking for your support at 845-482-4141 or wjffradio.org. We're trying to close out a $500 challenge that was issued just toward the end of Morning Edition this morning. We have $275 to go, so if you can help us with that, call 845-482-4141 or go to wjffradio.org. I'm joined in the studio by our reporter, Kimberly Izar. And Kimberly, while you were sleeping, we had another challenge, which was a $1,000 challenge that we met right away during the Morning Edition 8 o'clock hour.
Oh, that's
and
amazing.
That is going to enable us to join with the Sunlight Research Center, which is this great nonpartisan journalism support organization, which equips newsrooms like ours to provide them with fact-based, transparent, investigative journalism. And I've got the executive director of the Sunlight Research Center on the line here. It's Brandy Swicegood. Brandy, good morning.
Good morning. How are you all doing? Great to be with you.
Well, we're doing so much better now. We talked to you this morning when we were trying to raise the money, and we met the challenge, and we're so excited.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. And when I told Kim when she came in this morning, I said, hey, guess what? We met that challenge, and we're going to be able to with you. She got really excited.
Excellent. I'm excited, too.
Tell us a little bit more briefly about the work that you guys do to support newsrooms like ours.
Sure. So, essentially, what we do is we are a research desk for local newsrooms. So a newsroom like yours can call us up and say, hey, this is a topic we want to investigate, something we feel like our community needs to have a better understanding of. We don't really have the capacity to do all this research on our own. How can you help us to dig into this and support our work? So some of the research we've done with other organizations has been along the lines of helping them to investigate local folks in power, local county commissioners, local candidates for public office, those kinds of folks who really ought to be held accountable for the work they do and who your local community needs to really understand their background and the work that they're doing for you.
Brandy, what you can't see is Kimberly across from me, wheels turning, writing notes.
I sure am.
You already have some ideas here?
Yeah. Brandy, I just have to say I'm so excited to be joining the Sunlight community. I was on the website just before we hopped on and looking at some of the tools. The Saving at Risk data tool, which preserves government data, is going to be so critical for the health and housing reporting that I've been doing. I mean, we're seeing so much data disappear over the last few months, public data that journalists like myself really rely on. So just really excited to be joining the community.
We're so excited to have you. And yeah, the resources like that, I think, are one of the huge things that we can offer that are really sort of a quick hand up, right, to help you do the things that you are already so well placed to do. Like, you understand your community better than anyone else in the country does. But oftentimes, like, you just might not have the resources to do that little extra step, to dig that little bit deeper. And so, you know, if it's finding that data that's disappearing, we can help you do that. If it's, you know, digging into folks who are in charge in some of the local community healthcare areas, one of the training sessions that we held recently is a good example of one way we help newsrooms. We held a training session on how to investigate nonprofits in conjunction with the experts at ProPublica, who put together an incredible database of all kinds of nonprofit information from nonprofits across the country. And so we put together a training session to help reporters understand how to really understand, you know, how those nonprofits work, how to dig into their 990 forms and figure out where they're spending their money and where their money is coming from. So things like that that we hope will really boost your ability to help your community understand the folks, the people, and the powers in place.
845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org is where you can donate to help support us and our local journalism efforts, not only with the Sunlight, but just with what Sunlight believes in, that folks should be armed with trustworthy information to make decisions about issues that impact their lives. And that's the work that Kimberly's been doing since you just joined us in March. And already, out there and reporting and making these local stories that resonate with folks available. And it's only through the support of listeners like you, 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. Brandy, we're so excited to be working with you, and we'll be in touch, I'm sure. When Kim leaves the studio, you might get a call.
I can't wait.
Thank you so much. Kim, I'll let you go, and thanks again for all the great work you're doing. We've got more of Kim's reporting coming up later this week, and we've got more of Radio Chatskill coming up. We need to hear from you, though, to help us with this challenge we have. It's a $500 challenge from Bill and Patty.
Yes, give us a call.
In Big Indian. We have $275 to go. So thank you for the folks who have donated so far. We heard from Becky and Dylan, and we heard from Mary. We just need to hear from you. 845-482-4141, WJFFradio.org. You're listening to Radio Chatskill, and I'm Tim Bruno. As Texas is reeling from those devastating floods and as global security threats increase, Jackie Bray, the commissioner of New York State's Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Services, says her team has ramped up its efforts to protect New Yorkers. Bray says the division is also working to ensure residents know how to prepare for and keep themselves safe during extreme weather events and how to keep people safe in public and online. From the New York Public News Network, WAMC's Samantha Simmons spoke with Bray on Thursday for an update on those efforts.
The whole state has been in a really heightened threat environment, given world events over the last several weeks. And we've really been doing three things. The first is that obviously state police, along with local law enforcement, has stepped up their physical presence around sensitive locations. The second thing, and something my team is very involved in here at the Department of Division of Homeland Security, is we've stepped up our cyber monitoring, right? We already provide counties and cities and some townships with best in class, what we call endpoint protection. This is like almost like a guard standing at the gate, right, of all of our cyber networks. We monitor that information and then we provide rapid response. And so we have put a specific and special focus over the last several weeks on making sure that everyone, all our critical infrastructure partners, all of our towns and our counties and our cities, and certainly all of the state networks are at a heightened alert, watching that stuff really closely, responding really quickly. And then finally, we have been helping the New York State Intelligence Center, the NISIC, make sure that they have the capacity to respond to social media threats. Right. And that's both about what is happening around the world, but also really what we saw in Minnesota. I mean, we have had a political assassination in Minnesota over the, you know, within the last month. That should rock our country to the core. It certainly does someone like me. And so we have been briefing elected officials, briefing high profile officials in the state about how to protect themselves, how to stay aware, and then making sure that we're monitoring for any threats that we see.
Last year, we had several flooding events that killed people and animals and just did a lot of infrastructure damage. So how can residents stay safe, and how can they protect their homes and other items, and how can they, I guess, lean on the division for help with that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, 80% of what we do here at our division, at our Office of Emergency Management, is respond to severe weather, right? And in New York State, more often than not, that means flooding. And so a couple things that people can do right now to prepare. So one, you know, if you own your home or you rent a home, you want to make sure that you've elevated systems that can be elevated, right? Where is your fuse box? Where is your boiler? Where is your HVAC? Where are the major systems? And can you get them a couple feet above the ground? Number one. Number two, what is your drainage like on your property? You know, where I live in Marbletown, New York. Our drainage was really bad and we had to do some work to help with our drainage because we're at the bottom of a hill leading to a creek, right? And we knew that that could be problematic. And make a kit, make a supply kit so that you, if you have to leave home quickly, you've got something to grab, you've got something, and you know where you're going, right? So make a kit and make a plan. You want to know, which way do I run if I need to get to higher ground? In terms of the division, our job is threefold. Our job is to make sure that all the state agencies are ready to respond to extreme weather and to coordinate that response and that resource deployment, number one. Number two, it's to make sure our counties and our cities have the resources they need to respond. Right now, we are in the middle of deploying about $15 million worth of equipment that Governor Hochul put in her budget 2 years ago out to the counties, things like pumps and generators and temporary flood barriers to pre-position them. And then finally, our job is to communicate with New Yorkers. So I should say, if you are a New Yorker, we'd love you to sign up for emergency alerts. You can do that by texting your county, or if you're in New York City, your borough, to 333-111.
Continuing on safety here, by the time this airs, the 4th of July holiday will have come and gone, but firework use doesn't stop for the summer there. So what kind of fireworks are legal and how can people stay safe while using them at home if they choose to use them at home?
You know, I was just out in Western New York and I joined one of our fire protection specialists for an inspection of a sparkling device tent, or what most New Yorkers would think of as a fireworks tent that gets set up between June 20th and July 5th to sell in New York State. And we went over a lot of safety protocols with that individual. It's one of the roles we play here at the division. All right. So a couple things to know. First of all, the only things that are legal in New York are things that sit on the ground and they don't shoot into the air, right? They sit on the ground and they make sparks and they make a show, but while stationary on the ground, or things that you're holding in your hand. So like sparkling devices, you know, things that you might see, yes, at July 4th, but also maybe around New Year's Eve. So sparkling devices that you're holding in your hand, and those have to be wood. Those can't be metal here in New York. So that's what's legal. And that's true because the things that fire up into the sky, if you're an amateur, are really dangerous, right? People really get hurt when they don't know what they're doing with those types of fireworks. You know, mostly what we want is for people to practice sort of, you know, normal safety protocol, right? So if you've got kids, you want to monitor them at all times around sparkling devices, number one. Number two, you want to keep, if you're lighting them on the ground, you want to keep a fire hydrant or some way to put them out close at hand. Water works great, so a hose works great for these. Number three, you want to be careful when you're lighting it, right? You want to be smart about how you light it. An adult should light it, should always be the one that lighting it, and you want to be smart, and then you want to stand back from it.
Right on top of the website, there's a note about scam phone calls where the operator says they're calling from your offices. Has there been an uptick in those kind of calls recently?
So unfortunately, we had someone was spoofing our office's phone number and calling international students claiming to be federal Homeland Security and demanding that they send in their visa documentation. Let me just say, we would never do that here at the New York State Division of Homeland Security Emergency Services. We do not have an immigration mission in any way, shape, or form, and we do not participate in an immigration mission. And so that was important for us. You know, we got a few calls trying to verify this spoofed call, and it was coming from a number that did read on people's phone as if it was our main number. It was not us. It was a scam, and we wanted to make sure that was clear.
And lastly, a little on the lighter side here, a lot of state agencies have been working to make their social media more appealing to younger crowds. Something on your page that caught my eye a few months ago now is M the mascot. So who is M the duck?
Yes, M the duck is our emergency management mascot. We cooked her up or it up in September of 2024. And we really were looking for a way to teach people the difference between a watch and a warning from the National Weather Service, right? National Weather Service has an advisory, a watch, and a warning, and they mean different things. And for the layperson, it can be confusing to know what they mean. And so we were playing around with how to teach people that. We have a talented cartoonist on our team, the team came up with M, the emergency management mascot. We have evolved M now to not only be cartoons about how to understand emergency warnings, but really to help teach people safety tips. And what I love is that some of our first responders around the state are getting into it recently. Some of them brought a very large inflatable rubber ducky to our Swiftwater training facility in Oriskany, New York, unbeknownst to us. And so I like that people are getting in on it. But really, M is a way to have a little bit of fun, but also to try to do something to engage New Yorkers in safety tips and emergency planning.
And that was Jackie Bray, New York State's Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Services Commissioner, speaking with WAMC's Samantha Simmons from the New York Public News Network. And we're able to bring you those stories from the New York Public News Network because we're part of that network. And that's thanks to your support. Support us now during our summer fun drive, 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org to help us continue to bring you that statewide coverage. We're part of a network of many of the public radio stations in the state, at least a dozen. I think there's maybe even more than that. We all share some stories that we can bring to you, and we're able to do it because of donors like you. 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org. We've got $275 left on a $500 challenge we need to make. So if you can help us with that part of it, that'll help us get going on day one, official first day of the summer fun drive. A quick break for us. And when we come back, local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington.
It's Layla Faldin from NPR's Morning Edition. The demonization of fact-based journalism is one of democracy's biggest threats. This aversion to truth has taken hold as the number of local newsrooms has dwindled, leaving reams of disinformation to fill the void. In public radio, we have a responsibility to counteract disinformation. This station is an oasis amid all the noise and fiction. Having a reporter at the school board meeting, at City Hall, that is our resistance to the undermining of a free press. We resist by being there, by providing platforms for people to see themselves reflected and to see difference. We resist by building bridges and by holding people to account. We do it thanks to you. You give us the tools we need to fight attacks on truth by donating to this station. Here's how.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
WJFFradio.org or 845-482-4141. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and it's Monday. Working 9 to 5. Since we get to check in with our local economist and author, James B. Huntington, for some local economic perspective. James B., good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Well, let's jump in and find out what happened with Thursday's job report, which came in just before the holiday.
Yes, it's usually on Friday, but this time they moved it back a day instead of moving forward a week, which they usually do. So it is the same thing, the Bureau of Labor Statistics Employment Situation Summary. This time, for June's data, we were supposed to have, according to projections, 100,000 to 110,000 net new non-farm payroll positions. We got 147,000. That's been quite happening a lot. I mean, I would bet the over on any projections you see on these things, as the over seems to be winning 2/3 or more of the time. So joblessness Seasonally adjusted dropped 0.1% to 4.1%. The unadjusted variety went up from 4.0 to 4.4%. Expected seasonally, when the schools go out, a lot of jobs go with them. Adjusted unemployment went down 200,000 to 7 million. A few more, 100,000 more, were out long-term for 27 weeks or longer than last time. 100,000 fewer were working part-time for economic reasons or keeping short hours arrangements while looking for longer ones. That's now at 4.5 million. The two measures of how common it is for Americans to be working or officially jobless, the labor force participation rate and the employment population ratio, lost 0.1% and broke even and are now at 62.3% and 59.7%. Average hourly private non-farm payroll earnings went up 6 cents, a bit less than inflation, to reach $36.30. The American job shortage number showing latent demand, showing how many new positions could be quickly filled if we all knew they would be easy to get, that went up 650,000 to 17.5 million. That's not surprising seasonally. Well, overall, it was better than the usual seasonal worsening in the month. So we have more jobs. We have no right at all to expect 147,000 jobs. That's still a very good month, no matter what was predicted otherwise. So this was a positive month. We're not seeing much going on, any effect from tariffs, and we may not have much more imposed for tariffs because the emphasis in Washington seems to be now on getting countries to make trade deals, which usually they're welcome to do. So all in all, it was a forward-going month.
On Friday, 4th of July, President Trump signed that massive tax and spending bill to implement much of his domestic agenda. Let's talk a little bit about how that bill will affect folks, particularly with income taxes.
Yes, really all the effects I was able to find that are being discussed or projected are about income taxes. There are reductions really given to people in all categories. They have, we're expecting, according to a piece here from Yahoo Finances, high income earners with over 217,000 are looking at an average tax break of, at the lower end of that, about $5,400 a year, and as much as $12,500 for people who are in pushing $1 million a year. Middle income, $50,000 to $200,000. We're seeing an expected tax break of $3,000 for people between $1 and $200,000. Then between $75,000 and $100,000, it's looking like about average of $1,750 to $75, it's looking like a $1,000 tax break. Between $40 and $50, it's looking for $630 average. And people who are making below $34,600 are going to get an average of about $150, especially since they don't pay as much in taxes. Now, the disadvantage, the bad side a lot of people in the low income are going to see is what's happening to Medicaid and food stamps. We don't know how permanent this will be. We don't know what it will be like, but it's probably heading downward, and there may be a work requirement for food stamps. So we also have a child tax credit increase to $2,200. We have a $6,000 deduction for Americans over 65, but that's only good for the next four tax years. $25,000 deduction that will eliminate most taxes on tips will only go for about 3 years, and it doesn't cover everything. And a similar one, $12,500 to reduce taxes on overtime. Same thing goes, same length of time. So that's really what we have right now. But, I mean, these things, even though it's now law, these things are still subject to change. Mm-hmm. And we don't know exactly what's going to happen or how much of that might be offset by paying higher prices because things are getting tariffs. So we'll have to see, but generally there will be short-term tax savings, especially if you're over 65.
And speaking about the health care and SNAP benefits, according to the initial estimates from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, nearly 12 million Americans would lose health coverage and 3 million would not receive SNAP benefits. And the CBO is estimating this measure is going to add about $3.4 trillion to the deficit over the next decade. Again, it will all play out. We'll see. James B., we are in our fund drive, and so we don't have as much time to devote to your full segment here as we would like because we're trying to raise our own money here, as you know. I wanted to ask you about the importance of the economics of public radio and why it's important to support us during this time.
Yes, well, public radio provides a great deal of information and a great deal of variety. So it's good for the economy and good for quality of life if it keeps going. And the advantage of fund drives is that even if you don't like them when they're going on, they are for a limited amount of time, something like 4 weeks out of the year. That means with the other 48, you get commercial-free listening. So it's good for jobs and the economy. You heard it from me.
Yeah. And you're the public in public radio, so you guys can support us now at 845-482-4141 or go to wjffradio.org. But before we go, James B., we do want to check the numbers with you. What's going on with the prices from earlier this morning, and how did things change?
Over the past week, as of early this morning, we have gold 3308 plus 23, still looks good long term. Silver 3651 up 47 cents, for the ratio is now 90 to 1 between silver and gold. Silver has done unusually well, but 90 to 1 is really where we've been for a few years in general. If you had to pick an average amount, that would be it. Dow Jones Industrial Average, 44,829. That's up just over 1,000 over the previous week. Another very big week. We're in calmer times, really, despite the big bill, and the Dow has wanted to go up to rebound to where it was several months ago. NASDAQ, 20,601, that's up 328, almost as good. I mean, maybe all-time high or close to it. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, 66.83, the barrel, up $1.47. It may be up for prospects of better business and people using more of it, but it's still quite low in relation to what it's been most of the time the past few years. Bitcoin, 108,990, up 1,363. It likes something what's going on. It's pushing all-time records, and it may continue. Don't bet the farm, but it may well happen. British pound, 1.3590, down about a penny. Still quite strong. Euro, 1.1731, up 0.08 of a cent, almost nothing. Likewise, they're still doing quite well. Japanese 100 yen coin still at 69 cents, going nowhere. Overall, strangely enough, these are calmer times than we've had most of the months since January, and the markets reflect that.
Well, James B., keeping an eye on it for us. Thank you so much. We'll check in with you next Monday, see how things change. James B. Huntington, local author and economist, bringing us local economic perspective as he does every Monday. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, a local familiar eatery making a Hollywood appearance in a hit TV show. We'll find out more. Eating Upstate with Aaron Shearer is after a break. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
Hey, this is Steve Inskeep with NPR News. Fighting misinformation can be tricky. We question people in power. We want to hear from people in power, but we want to deliver their statements in context, surrounded by facts, which is what you deserve. It takes resources to get it right, and we can't do that without your support. Help us by giving to this station. Thanks.
Keep the community engaged and informed. Give now at wjffradio.org.
Or call us at 845-482-4141. We've got $275 left on a $500 challenge. We need to meet the $500 challenge to get the $500. So call us to help out with all or part of that. 845-482-4141 or wjffradio.org. It's our summer fun drive kicking off day one here officially. You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. And if you've watched the hit Apple TV Plus series Severance, you might have spotted a familiar local spot. The Phoenicia Diner is the roadside eatery nestled in Ulster County in Phoenicia. It makes a return appearance as Pip's Bar and Grill, a key location in the mysterious world of Lumen Industries on the show. What began as a quiet scouting trip by none other than Ben Stiller has turned into a national screen time opportunity for this Catskills classic diner. Aaron Shearer profiles the Phoenicia Diner in her continuing series, Eating Upstate.
In the pilot of the Apple TV series Severance, the character of Mark, played by Adam Scott, receives a VIP card for Pip's Bar and Grill after sustaining a minor injury on the job. Mark drives to a mid-century building located off a country road, where he uses his VIP card for a meal and has a spooky encounter with a former coworker. If you've seen Severance, and the building Pips is located in looks familiar to you, then it probably is. In real life, Pips is the Phoenicia Diner, located in Phoenicia. Since 2012, it has received widespread attention for its locally sourced casual fare, and it's the subject of today's Eating Upstate. The dining car that houses the Phoenicia Diner was built in 1962. First located on Long Island, it was moved up to its present location on Route 28 in Phoenicia during the early 1980s. The Phoenicia Diner would be operated by a Greek family with the classic greasy spoon fare until 2010, when Mike Cioffi purchased the diner. Here's Courtney Melzotsky, operations manager for the Phoenicia Diner.
He hadn't been working. He and his wife, Helene, owned a house in Margaretville, and they've had that for, I think, like 25 years, maybe more now, maybe even 30. So they often drove over to the area. And I guess every time they'd pass the diner, he'd comment on that he just thought it had so much potential, and that he, you know, he'd say certain things like about the curtains and the windows and make remarks about, you know, what he would do if it was his. And I guess one day they were driving, I think his wife or one of his daughters was like, well, why don't you just buy it? And so they stopped and went in and ate, and the owners ended up being in there, and they started chatting them up. And the next thing you knew, Mike, with no restaurant experience, was a restaurateur.
Mike Cioffi lived in Brooklyn and worked as a set builder for Broadway shows and TV programs like Saturday Night Live. In 2010, Cioffi sold his share of the set building company. The agreement included a non-compete clause, which effectively ended his career as a set builder. After buying the diner, Cioffi spent the next 2 years remodeling, then reopened the diner in 2012.
He really had a vision for it. He brought on like a great design team, and he wanted to make it look authentic, like it belonged in the Catskills, and not like, you know, your average Johnny Rockets sort of diner, which you see in a lot of cases now. Like, he didn't want the checkerboard floors. He didn't want the jukebox. He wanted to really go back. So they took a lot of time studying it, you know, the colors of the time, the things that had been in the diner that never were renovated. They honed in on those and then kind of built off of that to create that environment.
Despite having no prior restaurant experience, Cioffi showcased the local bounty of the Catskill Mountains from the very beginning.
I think that's one of the one of the greatest things, you know, Mike decided to do when he put this all together. He didn't just care about the look of it being authentic. He really wanted it to represent the Catskills and the community surrounding it. He wanted to make a good impact in everything around him. So he got to know local farmers and local purveyors, and he really wanted to showcase them in the food. You know, he never wanted to reinvent the wheel. He wanted to take all these great classics that we love, like turkey clubs, Reuben sandwiches, but instead of just being a breast from, like a turkey breast from Cisco that's been sitting in salt water for however long that, you know, someone just does whatever with, like, he wanted something better. So, and it's hard because when people see a diner, they think, you know, cheap food. So it's kind of like a tightrope we walk because we really want to be affordable, but we want it to be the quality you would get going into like a nice farm to table restaurant. And, you know, we're really lucky to have the amount of business we do. So it's so important for us to be purchasing for local purveyors because of our like success and the crowds we get now, you know, we're a large account to a lot of them. So that's a very important part of our business and what we do.
Over the next several years, the Phoenicia Diner received nationwide coverage from the likes of publications like Eater and the New York Times. In 2020, just weeks before the COVID-19 shutdown, the Phoenicia Diner published the Phoenicia Diner Cookbook.
It was a great time and an awful time at the same, like, kind of both, I guess. But looking back, I was there at the time. We had our launch party just like, I don't know, maybe like a month before COVID, it seems like. So we had all these plans for Mike to do signings and different events. And, you know, when COVID hit, that kind of all went away. But what was great is, you know, which I'm sure is why you're mentioning this, is so many people were stuck at home, so many people were cooking at home. And that was huge. And the sales were good. Like we did have an online store. So people were buying online merchandise and books, which was amazing. A lot of our customers who couldn't come see us were purchasing gifts for friends and things like that. And yes, we sold a lot of cookbooks, but what was great and kind of comforting and like a really uncertain and weird time being in this industry is everyone was posting pictures on Instagram of the dishes they were making. And it was like, it totally kept the, like, we were still open. We were serving outside, but like, it was so different. But those pictures and everything like really helped keep us going and like just made us like feel great about the experience.
The Phoenicia Diner works with a variety of local farms and farm-to-table distributors to source their food.
Veritas is one of the main ones. Paul, the owner of Veritas, is amazing. He is so community focused. He is a member of the Roundup Valley Growers Association, which we are too. He donates meat to a lot of their dinners and their events. He's donated to so many different events we've been a part of. He really works with his own farm and other farms as kind of a distributor. He has been with us since the beginning. Actually, speaking of COVID, when COVID hit, he actually sent out letters to us being like, don't pay me. I'm going to keep sending you product, but like, do not pay me until, you know, there's a light at the end of the tunnel for this. I think that's kind of a testament of, you know, building these kinds of relationships within your community and not just always buying from, you know, the big box stores, is like you have those kinds of relationships and that kind of trust. And it was funny, we sent him checks and he's like, I'm going to rip them up. Like, don't send them right now. We need to see what's going on. So that's a big one. We work with a gentleman named Steve Blakely who sources all kinds of local stuff. There's a couple local companies, Farm to Table and Hudson Valley Harvest. They're both distributors for like hundreds of local farms. So we get weekly lists of everything that's in season, who has it, who's selling it, and then they will go and pick up those products for us when we order them. So all kinds of farms.
Under its previous owners, the Phoenicia Diner was a location site for the 2006 movie The Night Listener with Robin Williams. It has also appeared in the 2018 movies Escape of Prisoner 614 with Ron Perlman and the slasher film The Ranger. Actress Shelley Duvall's final film, the 2023 horror movie The Forest Hills, was also shot there as well. During the pandemic, the Phoenicia Diner was approached by a location scout for a new Apple TV series, which had a different name at that point.
We often will get emails from location scouts just seeing if they can stop in or letting us know they already did stop in and, you know, that we might be up for a project. This particular scout I had worked with before, or at least talked to before. I don't remember. I don't think we actually did any filmings with them. But he emailed and was like, yeah, so we've been by. We've checked the place out. We have a director who wants to come by next week, but they want to come by either when you're closed or when there's not many people around. Like, what are your hours right now? And can someone meet us there? And we're closed on Wednesdays. So I was like, yeah, I can meet you there on Wednesday. And they just basically said, you know, it's an Apple TV project. All these things have fake names when they pitch them to you because they don't want things getting out. The name didn't lead me to believe it was Severance. In fact, I forget what the name was, but I know in this last season they said it because I was watching part of the finale and I was like, wait, that was the secret project name. I have to look that up. But so yeah, I came in and it was Ben Stiller and one of the other people on the project, I think one of the producers or maybe one of the cinematographers, they sat at the table that is in the first season where Mark is sitting at. And they were there for probably like 2 hours. And I just let them kind of do their thing. And they were blocking scenes and stuff like that. And yeah, like they're very polite, said thank you. Whatever else, made small talk. And then a couple days later, I feel like it was real quick. I just got the email being like, so we've, you know, looked at like 50 diners, like the director wants your diner, you know, these are the dates.
The first season of Severance was shot while COVID restrictions were still in place. Malzatsky remembers having to be subject to rigorous testing to ensure the health and safety of cast and crew.
I had to go over to Tech City in Kingston, where they were doing testing and like test with their entire production and then sign, basically go through a big process that I was going to be like in the same pod with them, that I would not be talking to other people, seeing other people. But it was amazing seeing them do it because it was seamless. You know, they have so many people in the production and like only people who needed to be inside were inside at any time. So it was just like a constant wave of like people in and out, only essential people. But yeah, we had to pod with them. We had to wear like face masks, visors, like all kinds of protective wear to be in there with anyone. And only the actors had their stuff off and only during takes and then would put it back on.
The filming of Severance resulted in some serious cosmetic changes to the diner, including the changing of signage. It was closed to the public during filming, which resulted in some very confused and very irate customers.
One of our core things we've always had is that we never close to the public during our regular hours. And there's only been a very few exceptions, and this was one of them. The first season, they did a lot more cosmetic work. And one of the things they did was actually take our sign out in front down and put a new sign up that said Pips, and people just lost their minds. Yes, we got angry ones being like, I can't believe you closed without saying anything, or like, how could you sell? I loved it there. But mainly like the people in the area closest to us were definitely not getting upset, but impatient because they knew something was happening. And I'm like super strict with if I sign stuff, like I'm not saying anything, even if I don't sign stuff. I love surprises. I freaking love them so much. So I wasn't going to tell anybody anything. And so they could tell by my face I was excited about it, but I was not going to let out what was going on. So they knew after we were closed, something was up. Once the Pips sign came up, they were just like, tell us now. So it was a really cool experience. And then yeah, I run our social media too. So I posted a picture of the Pips sign and people were just like, then it was like a wave. but now, you know, the aftermath, everybody's super excited that we were a part of it. So it worked out.
The runaway success of Severance has been a boon for the Phoenicia Diner. After the second season premiered in January, the diner experienced an uptick in business during what is usually a slower time of year.
We have been like consistently, we've been busy. We've been busier and busier every year, but I definitely noticed this year after the second season, I think because people waited so long and they did such a great job with marketing it, that it had so much more hype than the first season. And there was also so many publications talking about the filming locations and things like that, and TikToks and reels, you know, highlighting us. So we did have so many more people come the second season, and a lot of them not even realize we were in the first season, which was funny because I think that our part in the first season is a little longer. Maybe we get people, and it's funny, they always request the seat. We have like some kind of secret merch that has some Severance stuff we do, but I don't know that it hasn't brought like, you know, swarms of people, but I saw it a lot in our slowest months, like February, March, we're usually dead. And because of the timing of the series and everything else, we definitely saw an uptick in business. And it was really fun because the people who are there are like, we get really happy customers, but it was fun to have like that fanatic level to it too. It's like people were just so enamored by being in there and like sitting in the same seats. And it was very cute.
Aside from serving as a filming location, the Phoenicia Diner also sells pancake mix that is available at over 100 retailers. Later this summer, they will open a second location called the Phoenicia Diner Canteen at Blue Duck Brewing in Kingston. They also consult for other restaurants and have a new dining project in the works.
We're going to be doing a lot of the diner favorites. We'll have pancakes for brunch on the weekends, and then some new exciting pub style food that is very much in the vein of how we do our food at the diner. So and we have a diner that we bought a couple years ago that's sitting in storage that we're still looking for a location for. So Blue Duck, Phoenicia Diner number 2, pancake mix, all kinds of stuff.
The Phoenicia Diner is located at 5681 State Route 28 in Phoenicia. I'm Erin Shear. Eating Upstate is a production of WJFF Radio Catskill.
And thanks, Erin, for that. I'm Tim Bruno, and you're listening to Radio Chatskill. It's our summer fun drive. And want to thank Diane, who donated from Cultivate Wellbeing, the yoga and wellbeing studio. She donated to our fun drive because she was listening to Kathy Geary's show over the weekend now and then, and wanted to support us. 845-482-4141 or WJFFradio.org is where you can go to support us. We have $225 left on a challenge that we need to meet. It's a $500 challenge. Try to meet that before the end of the show today. So call us, 845-482-4141. WJFFradio.org. This summer marks over 5 decades since the Woodstock Music Festival defined a generation. Historian and musician Alex Prisgintis brings that moment back to life for his program Woodstock 1969, Tunes of Peace, Love, and Music at the Western Sullivan Public Library this Saturday. Alex is on the line right now to tell us more. Alex, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, we talked to you before about your work, how you combine your love of history and the electric cello. What inspired you to create Woodstock 1969?
Oh, I'm really excited to share this program with you, as well as the Sullivan County region. And all of the events that WJFF and I have discussed the past, they have been popular but already existing. This Woodstock program is brand new to my repertoire. And I use several of the same foundations, as you might say, with my other concerts. So with the cello, for those listeners who have attended some of my shows, I use some rather unusual equipment, such as a looping station and electric guitar pedals, something you'd much more commonly find in a rock and roll band. And I'm able to use those electric tools to really augment and broaden the range of this traditionally classical instrument. And I'm able to do that in this case to expand and include several new selections to my repertoire from famed musicians of that time period, such as Joe Cocker, Janis Joplin, the rock band Mountain, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and The Who, just to name a few.
And what's great about this is that you're not only performing music from the music festival, but you're also weaving in historical commentary because you are a historian. Are there stories or themes from Woodstock you think resonate with audiences today?
But the one thing that's been particularly special in this program is the ability to weave the stories of the actual festival and the period in the region with the counterculture that was existing during that era, some of the themes of which can certainly be applied today. And in the ability to weave in those elements, we're able to draw in tunes that were not exactly performed at the festival, but certainly resonate with that era. Perhaps the great example of that is, of course, Joni Mitchell's famed Woodstock song. Though Mitchell was not present at Woodstock, it really resonates well the theme of the event. And it's a song I'm very excited to share in general with an audience because it's adapted so beautifully well to the range of the cello.
You know, people associate Woodstock with peace, love, rebellion, youth culture. What did you uncover as you're putting the show together?
You know, that's a great question. And a lot of my work does resonate in the Sullivan County region. A bit of a different aspect, though. WJFF has had me interview on several of the Borchta Belt Hotel era pieces of one of my historical lectures. And it's interesting seeing the contrasts, as you might say, between the era of the Borscht Belt, which stray away from using the term as perhaps traditional, but how that clashed in some cases and in some ways combined with, as you very aptly said, not even the youthful and rebellious nature of Woodstock. I think a great term that applies to that era is the ability for people of diverse backgrounds to simply come together and unite. One of the favorite songs I like to associate with that is Joe Cocker's With a Little Help from My Friends, one of the several selections that is brand new to my repertoire. I look forward to debuting to new audiences on July 12th.
And that's July 12th at the Western Sullivan Public Library, Calicoon Branch in Calicoon, New York, upstairs in the community room at 1. There's more information at WSPLonline.org. Alex, after this, you have some other things planned for the summer?
I do have a very busy schedule for the summer, both within the Sullivan, Ulster, Orange County region and across the Hudson Valley. And for those who wish to keep updated on my events of either concerts or historical lectures, I encourage you to look at my website, alexprizgintas, PRIZGINTAS.com.
Alex Prizgintas, thank you so much for joining us. It's always great to talk to you. And you always bring something.
It's always a pleasure.
You always bring something so interesting to all of your work, and we really appreciate it. I'm sure we'll be talking to you later this summer. Thank you.
It's always a pleasure working with you in the helps of promoting these wonderful events across the region. Thank you so much.
All right. Before we go, we want to let folks know that we met our challenge for this hour. Thank you so much. We had a $500 challenge from Bill and Patty in Big Indian, and we just closed it out thanks to Meg from Parksville. So thank you, and thank you to Diane. Thank you to Becky and Dylan and Mary as well for helping us put that together and get that onto the Wheel of Progress. The Wheel is slowly moving here, but moving in the right direction toward our $55,000 goal for our summer fun drive. It's day one officially. If you haven't had a chance, you still have time. 845-482-4141 or go to wjffradio.org. Make your donation now. We need your help more than ever. We want to stay strong and we want to stay on the air. So donate now during the summer fun drive, wjffradio.org, and help us do that to bring you the local news, culture, and stories that you rely on. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Thank you for making Radio Catskill part of your summer.
Whatever you're doing, wherever you are, we're glad you have us with you.
Now, help keep us here for everyone who needs us.
Become a sound supporter by making a donation of $20, $30, $40 a month or more.
Or give a one-time gift of any amount. Support the news, music programs, and crucial information you rely on.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
WJFFradio.org.
Call us too at 845-482-4141. It's our summer fun drive, and you can help us meet our goal. You're listening to WJFF Jeffersonville. We're streaming live at WJFFradio.org. Local news, culture, and NPR, it's Radio Catskill. Today's weather, a stray shower or thunderstorm possible this afternoon. High 81. It's already up around 75, 78 here in Liberty. Cloudy skies tonight, low 67. On Point is next. It's 11 o'clock.